From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Roman Republic is once again flashing across the American imagination and the American television screen with HBO's new series, Rome.
400 years after the last king was driven from the city, the Republic of Rome rules many nations, but cannot rule itself. The city is constantly roiled by conflict between the common people and the nobility.
The Senate is divided, the Republic tested, Caesar is grabbing for empire, and Americans might well be listening again to see what we can learn from the story of ancient Rome. It can seem, and not for the first time, like deja vu all over again. The American obsession with the Roman Republic goes right back to the American Revolution. The Founding Fathers focused vividly on the lessons of the ancient Republic as they framed a nation they hoped would be steeled against a 52 BC-style decay. This hour on point, the American Republic, the Roman Republic, and the unfinished conversation across the ages between the two. We begin with a look at the new HBO series with New York Times TV critic Alessandra Standley. She joins me from New York. Alessandra, thanks for being with us.
Well, no, thank you for having me.
So here you've got it for us, an adventure story galloping along, gladiator fights, horseback chases, severed heads, full frontal nudity, Vestal virgins. What do you make of Rome?
I liked it. But I didn't think it was great. I just thought that for, you know, $100 million and, you know, an HBO big production, it was a little disappointing. It's good history. It's not, there are no glaring anachronisms, but it's a little boring.
We see in Bruno Heller, the co-producer, and in Jonathan Stamp, the historical consultant, working on this, a fairly direct desire to have ancient Rome appear as commentary on today's circumstances.
If that's the intent, it doesn't really apply to Iraq. I mean, you could squeeze in some idea that perhaps Caesar's adventures in Gaul are akin to Iraq simply because there was opposition to it in the Senate. But, you know, the United States is not an empire. We've never been good at it. We call it, whatever empire we built was in our own territory. And I don't think that's the real message or fun of this show. I think ancient Rome has always been fascinating, but I don't think it's just because, you know, we see ourselves in it. I think we see ourselves in it a little bit, and that is the fun of it. But I don't see American society seeing itself.
Nothing like a crystal mirror, and yet HBO's reached for this theme at this time. What can you tell us about the origins of this miniseries, Alessandra? Why this? Why now?
Well, I don't think I think what happened is several things happened at once. There were a lot of suddenly, you know, there was Troy, and there were a lot of sort of toga and sandal movies coming out. And I think one of the producers at HBO saw on DVD the old BBC production of I, Claudius, mm-hmm. and thought, well, maybe we could do something like that.
$130 million, and as I saw it, almost an entirely British cast. Have I got that right?
Yes, mainly British cast, yes. Not famous British actors, but very respected thespians.
So once again, the ancient Romans speak with British accents.
Yes. I don't know how you get around that, but that no one's ever been able to improve on that. The only thing that's weird is that then, of course, the slaves all speak with sort of Italian accents, which
right, the locals. Right, and the great framing of this is what moment in Roman history?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The great framing of the miniseries, the narrative here.
Oh, well, it's the story that I guess most people know, which is Julius Caesar returning from Gaul and on the brink of seizing power and turning the Republic into an empire, which is a story that, you know, we all know, even just from, you know, Caesar's palace in Las Vegas.
And here we get to see him literally crossing the Rubicon.
He crosses the Rubicon. The best thing about this is that the Rubicon is, of course, a tiny little trickle of a stream. You know, I think in most people's imagination, it's a huge torrential.
Right. It looks like a creek on a creek on HBO. What about the cultural life of Rome, the way it's portrayed here, Alessandra? What sticks with you most vividly?
Well, I have seen enough of these kind of movies and TV shows so that I expect debauchery and I expect paganism and I expect all kinds of brutality, that's the fun of it. You know, it's fun to see a world that has absolutely no Christian inhibitions. But I was looking for more sophisticated characters, and in fact, they seem pretty one-dimensional to me.
So as history, it still turns our heads as theater. I hear you kind of so-so on this one.
I didn't love it, and there are a lot of HBO shows that I love, and I loved from the moment, you know, from the pilot on. This is, I saw six episodes of this, and I think it gets a little bit better as it goes, but it's going to be hard for audiences to stick with it that long.
There's the critics' thumbs up, thumbs down, somewhere in between. Alessandra Stanley, thanks very much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Alessandra Stanley, TV critic for The New York Times. She joined me from New York. We are talking this hour about the Roman Republic, the American Republic, and the endless parable Americans find in the Roman past. You can join the conversation. Does the fall of the Roman Republic paint a destiny for the American Republic? Does strength and power somehow overwhelm the essence of democracy? And do you hear the stories of Rome with dread and fear for the American future, or are you just tuned into the full frontal nudity of HBO's new television drama? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Toronto is Elaine Fantham, Professor Emerita of Classics at Princeton University. She's a frequent elucidator of classic times for NPR and author of The Roman World of Cicero's De Oratore. Elaine Fantham, thanks for being with us.
It's good to talk to you, Tom. Greetings from Upper Canada and the original Empire Loyalists, now a multicultural city with a constant and passionate interest in the activities of the United States.
No doubt, the giant beneath. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be here, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Elaine Fantham, can you help paint in this broad strokes the picture of the moment at which this HBO drama is on which it's focused? You know this history well, better than us. What's going on at the point that HBO dips into ancient Roman history?
Yes, well, HBO has chosen to kick in 52 BC, which was a year in which the normal magistracies of Rome that should have been governing the city were disrupted, elections were postponed, there were gangsters, rival gangs on the streets, there was the murder of a popular politician followed by a riot in the Forum that burnt down the Senate House. Mm. Now, that, of course, is strictly local, you might say.
Yes.
52 is a good year, though, because this is the year in which the uneasy truce, in fact, it's barely a truce, it's one of those truces where dirty business is continuing all the time, the uneasy truce between those who stood for the more constitutional power of Pompey and of Caesar broke down. But Romans themselves reckoned that the real moment when the fate of the Republic was decided was in 60 BC when Pompey, who had returned from conquering the incredibly wealthy East, needed from the Roman Senate ratification for the settlement of his veterans and for the land settlements in the new Roman provinces.
Yes.
And they held out on him because they were afraid of his power. And silly fools that they were, of course, what happened was that they drove him into the arms of the younger and much more ruthless Caesar.
Let me ask you a couple of simple things here. At the time, at this moment then, is the Roman Empire extant? Has it already been built, the famous Empire of the Romans?
Well, if by empire you mean Rome's government of the provinces, yes, if you look at the boundaries of land owing obedience to Rome, you will include most of the Middle East. You won't include Egypt yet. You will include Tunisia and Algeria. You will include, because of Caesar, of course, virtually all of France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, odd bits of Germany just over the Rhine, Spain, though there are still troublemakers in Spain. Britain, they decided, was not worth the effort after Caesar's recce. In 55, they left Britain alone for another century. Mm. So pretty much the Mediterranean world.
And when we talk about the Republic at stake here, does that also mean democracy at stake? Would Americans recognize democracy in the Roman Republic?
Well, there are a couple of things that make Roman democracy, on the face of it, phony by our standards. Yes, the assembly of the people of Rome was supposed to be needed to ratify declarations of peace and war and major new laws. But, first of all, this assembly only took place in the city of Rome. Roman citizens, of whom there were many and quite privileged ones, Roman citizens up and down Italy and those governing beyond had no way of voting. Those in the city of Rome who had responsibilities like running their own store or hot food joint, you know, might not be able to come and vote. And my guess is that, and this is confirmed by the size of the voting areas, which would probably accommodate 2,000 to 4,000 people from a city of almost 1 million.
So a complex fabric then is now. We're going to learn a lot more about it, Jack Beatty. It's still so resonant with Americans, the power of today.
Yes, there's no end of allegory and parable to derive from this, and generations have been doing it, and especially the idea that one form of government can give way, that something that looks to be solid and good and serving the interests of the people can give way, that republics are not forever.
Jack Beatty, Elaine Phantom, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. There's a lot more we want to learn. We're talking about the Roman Republic, the American Republic, and the lessons from 2,000 years ago. You can join us. Do you see the parallel between the Roman Empire and the 21st century American superpower status? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Roman Republic, the American Republic, and the endless parable Americans find in the ancient Roman past. HBO out this week with its new miniseries, Rome. Let's listen to just a bit of that. Here in the Roman Senate is Cato, played by Carl Johnson, assailing Julius Caesar before a divided body.
I have a question concerning your friend and co-consul, the darling of Venus, Gaius Julius Caesar. Why does his chair remain empty? Why does he not come home? His illegal war is over. Gaul is long since on its knees. Why does Caesar keep his brave soldiers from their families and friends? For 8 long years, he has gorged himself like a wolf on the blood of Gaul and thereby made himself monstrously rich.
Cato in the Roman Senate assailing Julius Caesar and his illegal war. Why doesn't he come home? Well, he does come home, of course, with his armies across the Rubicon. The Republic ultimately falls. We're joined by Elaine Phantom, Professor Emerita of Classics at Princeton University. You've no doubt heard her conversations on Saturday mornings on NPR with Scott Simon on the great era of the classics. Jack Beatty is with us. And right now joining us from Providence, Rhode Island, Gordon Wood, Professor of History at Brown University, author of The Radicalism of the American Revolution and the Americanization of Ben Franklin. Gordon Wood, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You have pointed out repeatedly that Americans from the very earliest days looked back to Rome with rapt attention. What was it then that had the founding fathers so absorbed?
Well, actually, it's the whole 18th century. The Enlightenment was fascinated with Rome. They were fascinated with political health, political sickness. They wanted to know, why do states thrive? Why do states die? And, of course, Rome was the great example of a state that flourished and then died, and they wanted to know why.
So was it an inspiration or a cautionary tale? Both?
Oh, it's both. It's they applied the lessons of Rome to Britain. Britain was the comparable power at that time, the great power which had conquered the world, and that's what they thought of when they thought about Rome expanding. You see, there's this body of Latin literature that's written. I'm not a classicist, but this is a great body of literature about which we feed off of, that was written between, say, the first century BC, with Cicero, who's involved in it. In the events that we're talking about.
Yes.
And it extends right up to about the second century, middle of the second century AD. All the great writers, Livy, Sallust, Tacitus, especially Tacitus, are writing a pessimistic picture of their own times, looking back nostalgically to the Roman Republic. Why was the Roman Republic great, and then why did it die? Why did it end up in empire and destruction? And the lessons that they offer us really have had a powerful effect on Western culture and maybe world culture ever since. So the Americans are reading these writers, either in translation or in the original Latin.
And who was reading, and how did they build the lessons they took from that reading into the American Constitution, the structure of this nation?
Well, they build it into their understanding of what's happening to Britain. The Roman Republic had extended itself too far east. It had it lost its willingness to fight. The yeoman farmers were now hiring mercenaries. They were bringing back pomp and perfume from the east. They were living in luxury. Luxury is the great enemy of virtue. And so they had a lesson that this is what was happening to Britain. Of course, they're reading about Rome and they're thinking about Britain at the same time. Mm. And the lesson for Americans is that we have to break away from this corrupt, decadent power, and we will avoid the evils that Great Britain and Rome was plagued by. So they think we Americans are ideally suited. We have yeoman farmers. We still have militia. We don't have hired mercenaries like the British. They hired Hessian soldiers. Mm. And so that body of literature affected their thinking, both as a lesson about what to avoid, but also how to build a healthy state.
Mm. Elaine Trentham, you've written a lot about Cicero. What was the message that this Roman who saw it happen and who looked back then with nostalgia, as Gordon Wood says, what was the message he sends down to us across the millennia?
Well, I think it would be difficult to unify it in one message, but I would like to bring up an issue which I would love to hear from Gordon Wood,
yes,
which concerns Cicero. Gordon, I have always wondered why the founding fathers of the United States, when they set up the American Republic, created the institution of the presidency, which has a far closer resemblance to the position of ill-disguised power that Augustus would have 20, 30 years later. Now, part of this may have been, and Gordon can tell us this, because Cicero, when he looked at the mess that the Republic was in, and he was in despair, we have his private letters, he knew that it would be impossible unless compromises were made to prevent Caesar from coming back and seizing power. Cicero did speak about how what the Republican state that he wanted, which was very, very like Rome's own state, needed a wise moderator, a single wise guide, something like a Platonic philosopher or like the Roman image of Pericles. Is this why the founding fathers dreamed up the presidency?
Gordon Wood?
Well, I think the presidency, of course, comes 10 years after the revolution, that is, with the Constitution in 1787. In 1776, that was the last thing they had in mind. And it is the experience of the war and the 1780s that leads them to creating a constitution which is a reversal of some of the, democratic impulses of the original revolution of 1776.
So but if they studied Rome, weren't they worried
emperor,
king emerging?
Exactly. They were worried about, well, there were many people who opposed to the king. The only thing that made it palatable was the fact that they knew the first president would be George Washington. Otherwise, I don't think they would have created such a powerful office. but they were aware of this sense. They talked about the Federalists, the high Federalists who supported a strong president, talked about an Augustan age. So they're really already thinking about the age of Augustus, which, of course, is the age of the empire, the beginning of the empire. But it was also a time of great flourishing of art and literature. So there is a sense in which the Augustan age has its promises as well as its messages of imperialism.
So they saw the threat of the too powerful single leader, and yet they built it into the Constitution.
Well, that's right. We've still got that same presidency, and we know how powerful it can be. It was really a fear of the kind of democratic excesses that occurred in the 1780s that led them to create such a powerful government. Although, of course, the president does not presumably have the power to declare war or make peace, which the King of England had. So they thought that that was a severe limitation on this president. Of course, in the last 50 years, we've seen that limitation no longer applies.
And there, another echo, of course, all through the HBO special, there's the talk of Caesar and his illegal war. Cato charges him with illegal warfare, treason, theft, wants to bring those charges. Elaine Fantham, you've written about, of course, in the triumvirate that was at the top here, Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus. Crassus had taken Roman soldiers right onto the terrain where American soldiers are today and had a terrible experience with it.
Yes, this was an extraordinarily ill-conceived enterprise. Crassus himself had not had the military experience of either Pompey or Caesar, but it was a matter of personal ambition, personal honor and glory. He wanted to compete with Pompey's past achievements. Pompey had come home and was biding his time as a civilian. Caesar was in the middle of expanding his legal command in Gaul. Mm. It was very easy to expand a legal command in Rome. You invented a Tonkin Gulf. You said that the next door tribes had attacked your Roman allies, and you had a moral obligation to protect your allies by invading the next door tribe.
Necessity.
And, you know, you could get to the north coast of France bit by bit with a series of excuses like that.
But when Crassus ends up against the Parthians, I mean, the successor, I guess, of the Persians, his army's cut off in the Mesopotamia, and he's pretty thoroughly routed.
He's annihilated. He trusts his Arab guides, and I think that was a pretty foolish thing to do. His campaign was simply in search of glory. He was given the governorship of Syria. He wanted to bring home wealth and glory. And the Parthians had not, as far as the record goes, provoked this by any invasion of Kuwait or anything of that kind. It was simply an appallingly stupid choice because they were extremely clever fighters.
And as I read the record of the history, correct me if I'm wrong, he was captured, Crassus, later executed by having molten gold poured down his throat. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the tragedy, in a way, was that he took his son with him as a junior officer. And father and son were both, as you say, captured and executed. The molten gold was because Crassus was notorious at Rome for his practice of usury and his enormous wealth. He said that nobody could be a statesman in Rome unless he could pay the wages of an entire legion.
War and wealth and power all at play. It's a brew that we can relate to, whether or not the peril is exact. Let's hear another clip from HBO's special Rome. Here's Lucius Verinus, one of Caesar's soldiers, talking about the balance of power going on with Caesar's nephew Octavian and his mother Ettia.
I believe in the divinity of the Republic. If Cato believes the same, then I suppose I am a Catonian.
But Cato represents the rights of the nobility. Surely a plebeian like yourself would like to see some changes made.
It should remain as it was at the founding of the Republic. Why should that change?
Because the Roman people are suffering. Because slaves have taken all the work. Because nobles have taken all the land. And the streets are full of the homeless and the starving. Meanwhile, our senators stash their gold and lick the boots of the soldiery.
Well, I had no idea my son was such a firebrand.
The young Octavian there, who will, of course, become Emperor Augustus. Jack Beatty, you can hear the balls that HBO has in play in this show, and they do sound incredibly familiar.
Yes, ambition, the region, a government under fear, having to give way in some of its basic social institutions.
Slaves have taken all the work, insert immigrants or third world countries here.
There you are. And I wonder if this series gets around to the citizen, though, because it's easy, of course, to talk about how the institutions are flawed, the presidency having too much power and so on. But the founders also relied on Republican citizens, people who would put the interest of the whole above their personal economic interest. Their spirit, really, was ask not what you can do for your country, ask what you can do for...
Ask what you can do for your country, yes.
Thank you, yes. That was their informing spirit, and of course we live in a very different age. Ronald Reagan said, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Not, is the country better off? And that whole way of talking about the country as something that's above my economic interest, that and indeed I may have to sacrifice my economic interest for the country. That's the kind of decay, it seems to me, that the founders were afraid of, and that Tocqueville picks up as really one of the great threats to democracy and to republics, that citizens can lose that virtue.
Gordon Wood, how about it? Were the founders concerned about that balance between the personal and the commitment to the republic?
Oh, very much so, and that's exactly right. That virtue, which is the willingness to sacrifice one's private interests for the sake of the collective good, that was essential for a republic. See, republics had no monarchical devices to hold themselves together. There's no patronage. There's no aristocracy. There's no established church. Everyone's a citizen, and they have to be willing to cohere on their own. Otherwise, they'll just fall apart. I mean, that Montesquieu felt that they're very fragile things, these republics, and therefore they can't be very large. You can't get too big. You have too many interests, and things will fall apart. I mean, Montesquieu would have understood perfectly what happened in Yugoslavia when Tito's authoritarianism was removed. Mm. The Serbians, the Bosnians, and the various ethnic groups and religious groups just were at each other's throats. He would have said, of course, that's why you need monarchy. That's why you need authority. And, of course, monarchy has existed throughout most of the history of the world for good reasons, and republics were fragile, so they were quite aware of this. Could a republic exist? And that question runs right through our history. I mean, that's what Lincoln is talking about at Gettysburg. We are the last best hope. This is his refrain. Can a democracy exist? Can it sustain itself? Because it requires a special quality, a moral quality in its people. And that is an issue that I think we Americans have continually obsessed with. We're always worried about corruption to the point where Europeans are puzzled by our obsession with our own morality.
But if there's a lesson from Rome, perhaps it is, we do well to stay alert to that today. Let's begin to let our callers in here. Peter's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, I think that in some ways we're back to 180 A.D. To Caesar's son, Commodus.
Now we're getting way on down the line from 52 B.C.E.
Right.
But what do you see in 180?
Well, it's when things the accomplishments were undermined, where they began to I think wage war with the North again. Laws were rewritten, rights of the people were suspended.
Peter, let us look at exactly how that unfolded, Elaine Phantom. On the other side of this moment, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, how did it all fall apart? And where did the Republic end up?
Well, you can have a short-term view of this or a long-term view. Let's have a short-term view. I don't know, by the way. I only have half of the HBO episodes.
I don't know how far they're going to go. We'll take the real deal.
When Caesar died, you know, nothing is ever solved by assassinating a leader, even if he is a tyrant, even if his rule is something you disapprove of, like poor old Fidel Castro. Once Caesar died, all the lesser people began to compete for wielding power, and the charisma of that odious young man, and he is odious in HBO, he sounds like the worst kind of British public schoolboy, that odious young man, Caesar's heir, Octavius, who became Octavianus, who became Augustus, that charisma carried with it all Caesar's legions, and so he was able to hold the Senate hostage and force them to give him the highest existing Republican rank, the rank of consul for the year. And then he ganged up with Mark Antony, and they didn't trust each other. It was simply a convenience that they could share their separate power to overthrow the will of the not particularly capable and efficient Senate.
And off it went, the Republic left in the dust. Elaine Phantom, Gordon Wood, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking this hour about the Roman Republic, the American Republic, and the lessons across those 2,000 years. Does the turmoil of the late Roman Republic mirror, for you, America's experience today, or is this time fundamentally different? Is America fundamentally different? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Roman Republic, the American Republic, and the endless parable Americans find in the Roman past. HBO out with a new miniseries called Rome. You can join the conversation. Do you hear the stories of Rome with dread, anticipation of the American future, or are these just ghost stories from the distant past? Don't apply. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's listen to just a bit more from HBO's Rome. Here's Caesar rousing his soldiers to go with him back to Rome.
Our beloved Republic is in the hands of madmen. This is a dark day, and I stand at a fork in the road. I can abide the law and surrender my arms to the Senate and watch the Republic fall to tyranny and chaos. Or I can go home with my sword in my hand and run those maniacs to the Tarpeian Rock!
Caesar, there played by Kieran Hines in HBO's Rome. We're joined this hour from Providence, Rhode Island, by Gordon Wood, professor of history at Brown University, author of The Radicalism of the American Revolution, and from Toronto by Elaine Fantham, professor emerita of classics at Princeton University. Jack Beatty's with us. George is calling right now from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, George. What do you think?
Hi there. A comment and a question. I think it's difficult to draw parallels between specific civilizations other than to say there is a general pattern of birth, growth, maturity, and decline, and we're going through that, and Rome went through that. I guess we remember the ones that lasted the longest, and Rome in the Western civilization is certainly the longest, 7 or 8 centuries, I guess. But of great interest to me is the period called Pax Romana and the comparison to today to what some people have talked about as Pax Americana.
Mm.
And my sense, and your learned commentators can help me on this, is that Rome probably didn't set out strategically to conquer the known world and institute a Pax Romana. But they found themselves there and apparently were fairly comfortable in exercising the power that needed to be done to promote their interests. And
in that, like or unlike the USA?
Well, I think the USA finds itself, not intentionally, but in the same sort of having a worldwide hegemony of power, but I don't think we're comfortable in using it or knowing what to do with it.
That's terrific, George, and let us pick it up. Elaine Fantham, if you'd be good enough first, just to paint, again, broad stroke, the road to empire for the Romans. Was it always a goal? How did they come into it, and did they see it as it grew as a threat to their own republic?
Well, there's a school of history that was dominant for most of my youth and middle age, I suppose, that believed that on each occasion when Rome expanded to take control of another section of the Mediterranean, Greece or the coastal Turkey and so on, it was a sort of accident forced upon them by provocation, that they never really wanted the responsibility of administering the provinces, as they call them. I think this is rather doubted now. There was always a less spoken about financial pressure from the equivalent, I suppose, of Halliburton to exploit the wealth of the new provinces. Rome had a powerful financial class. So the expansion probably didn't take a recognizable public political form, but was the result of responding to economic pressures.
And let me ask you,
I think they ran the empire quite well for quite a long time.
Name your Roman, could look out on America's superpower status today, its global presence today, do you think a good old ancient Roman would see this as an empire, or would not recognize it as an empire in his own or her own terms?
A well-informed Roman would probably recognize it. I mean, the question is, when is a protectorate really a kind of domination? And countries like the Philippines, for instance, I don't know whether you think of them as part of the American Empire or
not. They certainly were, literally, at one time.
Mm.
Gordon Wood, what about George raises the American character and attitude and draws a distinction between ours and Rome, saying we're less comfortable with this idea of empire. Are you feeling that?
Well, I think it's a question of where are we? We're certainly not at 50 B.C., but somewhere maybe into the 2nd century A.D. Who knows? I don't really put much stock in these kinds of historical parallels. I think history is so different, although many people do, and of course, the 18th century did. I mean, they believed they weren't really historians. They were political scientists, so they were interested in laws of political health. How do you create a healthy state? Mm. And they did autopsies on the past, you might say, on the states that died to find out what killed them. You could say the case was applied to Britain in the 18th century. That was steeped in corruption and luxury, mm-hmm. and that was the end of Britain, just as the Roman Republic had fallen, so Britain would fall. But, of course, Britain didn't fall. It went on, even losing the colonies, it went on to have a greater empire than it ever had before. So one has to be very careful about drawing parallels between the two points in history, so far removed and in time and also in character.
Yeah, well, we're not looking for ditto marks here, but they had to be very attuned to the empire facet of the Roman experience, with the British example right in front of them.
The 18th century founders were. Oh, of course. They were, of course, political scientists interested in this, and so they were very much attuned to this. They wanted to avoid the errors that the Roman Republicans had made. The extent of copying is extraordinary. I mean, think of the Senate. That
yes.
term, mm-hmm. capital, the term capital. And then all of the names of our towns. Antiquity had a fascination for us. I mean, someone like Cato was fascinating. I mean, Joseph Addison's play, Cato, was Washington, George Washington's favorite play. He saw it over and over again, had it played for the, put it on for the troops at Valley Forge. Mm. It's an Enlightenment tract, but it is about that man that was quoted earlier in the program, Cato, who took on Caesar and committed suicide rather than give up his liberty to a tyrant. That was the kind of message these Americans wanted to hear. In fact, many of the phrases that the founders used, or Nathan Hale, I regret I have but one life to give for my country, liberty or death, those phrases come out of Cato, that play, the Addison's play. So the 18th century is alive and well for them, and they're familiar with it, and they want to avoid the errors, as they see it, that the Roman Republicans experienced. They want to avoid luxury. Mm. They want to avoid the kind of conditions, social conditions, which created the empire, or the civil wars that led to the empire.
Mm. Let's get another caller. Michael's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just want to make a comment about the notion that American hegemony, Roman hegemony, anything that's related to the expansion of powers throughout our history, theirs or otherwise, or
yes.
comparisons, do not happen by accident. That they are things that we are purposeful about, we have interests that we wish to further, and we'll say, well, that we just found ourselves in a situation. Wrong. Wars don't just break out. Situations don't happen by accident. We had purposeful intents in every instance now, as the Romans did, and we should be held accountable when we're wrong and be praised when we're right.
And what can we learn from their example? Not to say it's the same, but do you take a bit of learning away, Michael?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, who cares really about the comparison? Are they like us? That question that you just asked is the salient one. Have we learned anything from looking back at these historical events other than the fact that I don't even know exactly how to say it, but I don't think we've learned anything from it. I think we avoid those lessons for the sake of moneyed interests.
That would seem a shame. Jack Beatty, Michael points to the deliberateness of history, that, you know, there is maybe a random quality too, but there's also deliberateness. After the fall of the Soviet Union, especially as the 90s rolled on, there was a lot of talk about Americans picking up a global mantle. both on a sort of humanitarian hawk side, the liberal side, and conservative or neoconservative side. And then 2002, President Bush at West Point, of course, laid out the vision of the future in which the U.S. would monopolize global military power indefinitely. These are not small ambitions.
No, they're not. And you mentioned the late 80s. Paul Kennedy at Yale wrote a book rather up the line of our caller from South Carolina about empires and about how empires overstretch themselves. Military commitments go beyond what the economies of these countries can support, or they drain the economies. And he points to Spain, of course, which was the dominant power for centuries here, and it now a vanished supremacy. He talked about Britain and Britain's high water mark and the implication, and also about the United States, and wondered aloud, this was still while the Cold War was on,
yes,
whether we were approaching imperial overstretch. Well, there's now not a Cold War, but we are investing our treasure in imperial ventures, and we do say we will not allow another superpower to emerge. Well, that's a pretty big ambition to sort of bottle up the world. So the decline and fall of empires because of their overexpansion that's a historical constant, it seems to me.
Elaine Fantom, when the United States went into Iraq, you were very clear in saying, from your experience in Roman history, I guess, this is a mistake. This is almost doomed, as I recall your words then.
Yes, I did feel that. And, of course, I don't know as much about strategy or about America's military strength as the people who were making those decisions. But it did seem to be another piece of hypertrophy, overstretch. And, you know, at the end of the Roman Republic, at the beginning of what turned into the empire under Augustus, this was what Livy, the Roman historian, said: Rome has bloated to the point where she is dying, as it were, crushed under her own hypertrophy and excess. And if I can put in a political issue here, I believe in democracy, but I do not believe it is possible when a state is beyond a certain size. Aristotle said that a well-run state had to be small enough for you to be able to take in and recognize all its citizens. And he was talking about a size of, say, 10,000 male citizens, probably comparable to our founding fathers, the size of the colonies when our founding fathers, your founding fathers, they're not mine, devised what was probably an excellent constitution for a citizen body with a trained governing elite, conscientious and trained governing elite.
Gordon Wood, what about that? You can hear that fear. We had a guest on just the other day, and as a throwaway line, and you hear this, as a throwaway line, kind of at the end of an answer to a question, said, no republic has lasted longer than 300 years. We can quibble over the date, but the idea that there's an expiration date on republics, Elaine Fantom saying the U.S., I guess by extension, may have grown beyond what's manageable for republican government. How do you look at that from your eye?
Well, the opponents of the Constitution in 1787-88 said the same thing, that this United States was much too big to sustain a republic. It had to remain a confederation, which the Articles of Confederation were essentially like the European Union today, 13 independent states held together by a treaty. But the United States that was created in 1787 with the Constitution we still have was seen to be an unwieldy kind of state, a single government governing such a vast continental-wide territory. It was impossible. Montesquieu said the same thing. You can't have a large republic. Well, that was the argument that Madison and the Hamilton and the other founders had to deal with, and they attempted to answer it, drawing on some remarks by David Hume. And they gave a very powerful answer to that problem. Mm. They felt that it was possible, that the very extent of the country would neutralize the interests, the very selfish interests, and allow for a public good to be promoted.
So whose view is being borne out as you look around today?
We have both views all the time. I mean, a former Speaker of the House said, said all politics is local, and trying to herd 435 cats in the House of Representatives is almost impossible because they're all obsessed with their local interests. So we have this continuing problem. How can we hold such a vast, diverse country together? But I would say, with exception of the Civil War, which can't be minimized, the United States has done pretty well. I don't see any lessons from history in this sense. History is each period is so different that the idea that there's some transcendent science of sociology or political science that can be applied to states, it seems to me, is not very convincing.
Elaine Phantom, our time is running short, but before we go, how distant from the common people of Rome were the nobility at that time, those who lived in that famous luxury? HBO has them bathing in getting bathtubs or gallons of bull's blood and, you know, making love in front of the slaves and speaking very disparagingly about the common folk. Was that the way society broke up?
Well, that could be it. I mean, the bull's blood, by the way, is an anachronism. I won't waste your time on it now, but that could not have happened in Rome at that time, and least of all to a woman. It's a ritual that was introduced later.
Duly noted.
I think we have to believe that Rome, like Britain in the 18th century, like the United States, was sustained by the less extravagant, more conscientious, middle-of-the-way leading figures in their own communities. The Italian communities produced a number of very good leaders and were relatively well-run. These people maintained a standard of morality that you or I would not be embarrassed by, as opposed to the debauchery that HBO is providing to keep its listeners awake.
Jack, we're going to have to count on that same kind of middle of the society, I think, to stand up and make sure there is no repetition of history, as Gordon Wood says.
Yes, but what some people are afraid of course, is that the behavior of the aristocrats in history and our celebrities today, it just seeps down through the media and infects the whole of society, and so that virtue gets corrupted by these flagrant examples of debauchery that pretty much fill the gossip columns every day.
Well, history may not repeat itself, but it sure as heck can draw our fascinated gaze and fix it. It's been a fascinating conversation. Elaine Phantom in Toronto, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure.
Wonderful to have you. Elaine Phantom, Professor Emerita of Classics at Princeton University, author of The Roman World of Cicero's De Oratore, and Gordon Wood, author of The Radicalism of the American Revolution at Brown University. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jack, good to have you as always. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Senior producer here is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.